I don't know why, but I thought it was going to be warmer today than it was yesterday. And man, am I wrong. Highs today of 55. Right now it's 40. And then we kind of get on a roller coaster. I wouldn't get the car washed unless you belong to the Wash It As Many Times As You Want Club. And I'm thinking about that, but that's neither here or there. 60% chance for showers tomorrow, 45% on Thursday, 40% Friday, Saturday. Looking really wet. The temperatures rise to Saturday up until 70 degrees, up to 70 degrees. And then Sunday, cold front comes through, 57 for a high. Sunday, 43 for a high on Monday. But hang on, next Tuesday, the high is going to be 33 degrees. The low is going to be 24, so that means freeze precautions. More on that as we get closer and they narrow that forecast down. So how do you get your news? Where do you get your news? What do you know what to believe? Do you care what's true and what's not? Or do you just seek out what you want to know, what you want to be true? Jesse Holcomb joins us now, professor of journalism and communication at Calvin University, also a former associate director of research at the Pew Research Center. Good morning, professor. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to be with you again, Tommy.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time. Boy, you want to take us back to what happened with the fight before the holidays with the government shutdown and some of the stuff that was going on with Elon Musk and Twitter?
Well, as we many of your listeners probably know, Elon Musk, the entrepreneur and one of the most famous businessmen in the world, household name, has now been elevated to the central core of the federal government. He's going to be running this DOGE office, this new Department of Government Efficiency. Of course, many of your listeners know he is the, I wouldn't say new owner of Twitter anymore, Twitter now X, and has really come to dominate a lot of these conversations in American politics, has actually been able to use his, essentially, his army of followers on X, the platform that he owns, to kind of pick up their pitchforks and dominate a conversation. And this actually spilled out into real life in Capitol Hill, where he was able to use all these minions, essentially, to exert control over a spending bill. And that potentially opened the door to a government shutdown several weeks ago. What is concerning to folks like myself and perhaps other people in the news industry and journalists is that there can be some false information that gets out there in these kinds of Twitter storms, and it can drown out the ability of fact-based, nonpartisan journalistic reporting to kind of help us all understand the truth of the matter.
So here's the thing. A longtime politician told me a long time ago that there are leaders, some leaders who call themselves, some people who call themselves leaders, see which way the crowd is going, then they head in front and they call themselves the leaders. Other people really are leaders and decide which is the right way to go and then try to lead the crowd that way. When you have people that are contacting their representatives and senators in Washington based on false claims about spending bills, things like a NFL stadium in D.C. that proved to be false. It actually prevented that. Musk said the original bill funded a bioweapons lab. It did not. Something about $60 billion for Ukraine, which it didn't appear to. Again, these bills are very complicated issues and very complicated matters, and there's also context and subcontext, and this leads to that. It's not simple. At some point, the elected people have to say, okay, that's fine. You can vote for me, you cannot vote for me, but I know what's true and what's not, right?
Well, in theory, and to be sure, there are plenty of leaders who have integrity and the essential traits of leadership who are on Capitol Hill who know that their job is to take tough votes on bills. And we've got them on both sides of the aisle, mm-hmm. Tommy. But the fact is, I mean, it's human nature, right? If you are getting a pressure campaign on social media, and if you're a lawmaker who spends a lot of time on social media, I think it'd be naive to say that that stuff doesn't have some kind of an effect. Now, that's not to say that there should not be the channels or the ability for the vox populi, right, for citizens to make their voices heard. That's certainly not what I'm saying. However, if you're a lawmaker who is only listening to what's happening on social media, and if there happens to be a really loud and misinformed sort of cantankerous mob on social media, and that's influencing, chiefly influencing your votes, then I'd say that that's reason for concern for our civics.
And I'm also all for a vox populi, so long as it's an educated electorate and they know what's true and what's not, and urging their representatives to act or senators to act on what's true and what's not, as opposed to misinformation or, in some cases, disinformation, right?
Right, exactly. And I think the experts would argue that the difference between mis and disinformation is, you know, with the former, it's sort of normal that in the course of things, there would be some mistakes that get out there, sort of misinterpretations in good faith of what's in a bill. As you said, these bills can be very complicated and messy. And, you know, any news reporter will know that the basic facts of the matter are actually a lot harder to pin down in many cases than we tend to think. Disinformation, on the other hand, is often characterized as a sort of willful manipulation of the facts for self-interested purposes by the actor.
On New Year's Day, I wasn't feeling great, and I was watching a little bit of the Twilight Zone in between the coverage of the Bourbon Street attack, Twilight Zone Marathon, and I caught the episode where they thought Martians were landing, and then one rumor led to the other, and then everybody freaks out. That was made in the 50s, I think, or the 60s. And I got to thinking about the parallel between that and what's going on social media, where people get all revved up over something that's not even true to begin with. I see a parallel here with the Seattle windshield thing that goes back to the 50s. So when we come back, we'll talk about the difference between media and reporters, and while it's true that everybody is perhaps the media because they go on social media and post, that doesn't make them reporters. And also about how do you discern what's true or not when it comes to making an informed choice and being an educated member of the public. We're talking with our friend about what's real, what's not when it comes to news, Jesse Holcomb, a professor of journalism and communication at Calvin University, former associate director of research at the Pew Research Center. 621 traffic now, WWL. 625 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jesse Holcomb, professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University, former associate director of research at the Pew Research Center, about how do you sort out what's real and what's not online, and who do you trust to give you unbiased news. And Professor, going back to my Twilight Zone example of Maple Street, I think the Martians invade Maple Street. Come to find out, there were actually, with this Twilight Zone episode, Martians behind it, but they were making people freak out by blinking the lights here or turning that off there, which is kind of akin to what happens on social media with trolls and people putting out misinformation or disinformation. So with all that being said, what advice would you give people to I guess, discern what's true and what's not? And I guess the first thing you'd be willing to do is challenge yourself and what you believe, maybe?
Exactly. I think that's right. I once read a quote that kind of stuck with me when it comes to this, which is that we should be curious when we're furious. Okay, so if you're on social media
say that again. That's a great phrase. Say it again.
Be curious when you're furious. And here's what I mean by that. If you're on social media, or forget that for that matter, watching cable news, and you see something or read something that just gets you hopping mad about politics, about the world these days, about some other group of people or political party, take a pause and take a breath and think to yourself, why am I so mad? Okay? Because the chances are, there's a chance in that kind of situation that you're mad by design. The fact is, Tommy, these social media platforms, and it's not necessarily something nefarious, but they are engineered to keep and hold your attention. Mm-hmm. And one thing we know is that anger, what psychologists would call that kind of arousal, will keep people engaged. Now, it's not necessarily good for us, okay? Sometimes when we get really mad about something, it can blind us to the facts and whether there's something, right? It can fit a preconceived narrative that we have. And so we're going to pay less attention to whether something is entirely true or not. And chances are, if it's making us really mad, maybe it's only presenting one side of the story. Okay. By contrast, I would argue that the thousands of community and local journalists and even national reporters around the country, they're not perfect, but they are trained and incentivized to try to do the best they can to present the clearest version of the truth as we know it about a certain topic or otherwise. They're out there interviewing real people. They're doing real research. They're eyewitnessing events. And, you know, despite their mistakes, sometimes they're incentivized to get it right because they're going to hear about it if they don't.
I had a conversation the other day with a local official about the way something was being reported in the national media as it related to the Bourbon Street attack, and it wasn't accurate. And I just asked people to, you know, consider that when they know maybe something that happened, and it's not necessarily of a nefarious nature, but and Professor, this goes to my, you know, I say the news sometimes should be 15 minutes, sometimes should be 90 minutes. It depends on what's happening, right? Because I think what happens is sometimes you get short shrift paid to things that should be gone into in detail, and then other things become news when they really aren't because you got to fill 30 minutes. And it just seems to me that when it comes to even mainstream media, people need to just remember things that happen locally and remember with limitations when it comes to, I guess, reporting and absolute truth. I guess it goes back to what you said. Be curious and do some digging on your own, right?
Exactly. And thank a local journalist.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Jesse Holcomb, professor of journalism and communication at Calvin University, also a former associate research director of research at the Pew Center. Somebody texted in and said, I remember it'd be interesting to go back and look at all of the news reports, top stories in the past, see what was true. For instance, in the 1990s, all the networks said Miami would be underwater by 2012 due to global warming. Well, that's a fun remembrance, and that's nice to say, but I think maybe somehow it's like the old sitcoms where, you know, it gets all blurry, and well, that's not quite the way I remember it, and I texted back. I'd love to see stories on it. If you got some stories from major media outlets saying Miami was going to be underwater by 2012, I'd like to see them, but I don't really recall that. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tuesday, January 14th. Hard to believe it's already 2 weeks into the new year. It seems like just 2 weeks ago was January 1st. Barry Klein joins us now, LSU climatologist. Talk about the weather, El Nino, La Nina. How you doing, Barry?
I'm doing great.
Barry, let's talk about the fires in Los Angeles, if we can, please, and the conditions that led to them. I don't know if you, I guess that's kind of within your purview a little bit.
Absolutely, sure.
Because they had a tenth of an inch of rain, I think, since March 1st, and I don't think people quite understand. And you know, politics got involved in some of this, and I'm trying to limit this to the science of it. But talk about the conditions that just led to these wildfires in LA.
Yeah, so we've been drifting towards La Nina for some time, and that's affecting our weather too, but it's also affecting the weather in California. Now, California is normally dry in the summer anyway, so that's pretty typical, but normally they get most of their rains in the winter. But when we're in a La Nina, the jet stream tends to deflect further northward. It makes Northern California wetter than normal in falls and winters. But it makes Southern California drier than normal because that storm track, it's, you know, pushed up into Northern California and up in the Pacific Northwest, and it leaves Southern California high and dry. So, like I said, it's normal for them to be dry through the summer, but normally they get their rains in the fall and winter, and it just hasn't happened this year. And as a result, you get those Santa Ana winds, you know, this high pressure that sits up over what we call the Great Basin, and it pushes these, northeasterly winds down onto Los Angeles, and they move downslope. And when they move downslope, they get warmer than normal. And so you get these high winds. It's hot. way hotter than it should be. And all that vegetation out there hasn't seen any rainfall in many, many, many months. And it's just tinder, just ready to go. And once you get those fires going and with all that wind happening, it is very, very hard to get it under control. So, and that's what we see playing out over there. It's just really difficult to manage. And I don't see any relief, no short-term relief in sight right now.
And I heard during the football game last night, they were talking about Southern California, and I get that. But Northern California has also had their problems with wildfires, right?
It kind of reaches up to about San Francisco. And as you get, north of San Francisco and up into the northern part of California, there aren't nearly as many people up there. But it's actually been wetter than normal up in that neck of the woods. So,
but I guess I'm saying it depends on El Nino and La Nina, whether it's Northern or Southern California that has the fire risk.
Yeah, well, in this case, with La Nina conditions, it's been wetter than normal up in Northern California, but the South is what's really getting plagued right now with all this.
So when it comes to us and hurricane season and La Nina, El Nino, I always get them confused. A quick refresher on these?
Yeah, so the whole ENSO cycle plays a big role in our tropical weather. So El Ninos are good for us. It creates hostile weather conditions over the breeding grounds in the Atlantic Ocean. Now, keep in mind, the El Nino, La Nina originates in the Pacific, but it affects the weather patterns really all over the globe, and it does affect what's happening in the Atlantic. And so when we're in El Nino, we get, lots of wind shear, and that tends to limit the number of storms we get and helps reduce their intensity. But when we're in a La Nina, the opposite effect takes place. We have very conducive conditions for storms to form, very favorable upper air, very little wind shear, and we tend to get more storms than normal. So we were thinking, as we were going into this hurricane season, that this La Nina was going to develop at the back end of the hurricane season.
Wait, hang on. When you say going into this hurricane season, you mean the one coming up?
Last year.
Last year.
I mean last hurricane season, yeah. So we kept waiting for it to happen, and it just never did. And as a result, this season was not the record-breaking season that we were anticipating. But it just so happens that this La Nina just took a long time to form, and NOAA just officially declared us to be in a La Nina now. So, by the grace of God, we missed that during the hurricane season, which is a good thing for us.
So let me take a break. We'll sort it out when we come back. One thing I did, and hopefully this will help me remember, I took some notes, Barry. El Nino has an O in it, so that means it's good for us. La Nina has an A in it, so that means it's bad for us. That's my mnemonic device, and that's what I'm going to use to remember from now on. Let's see if it works. Barry Keim,
man, I love it.
Barry Keim is our guest, LSU climatologist. We'll continue the conversation. We come back. Again, any questions? 504-260-1870. One of them pops up. I thought La Nina meant we wouldn't have a good winter. I don't know what a good winter is, but you can text me back and let me know what that means. 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker with our friend Barry Keim, LSU climatologist. Barry, somebody texted in and clarified their text that they thought La Nina meant we wouldn't have a cold winter. And apparently we do have some cold weather coming in. We'll get to that in a second. But what role does that have to play? Where do we stand now with La Nina, with the winter, and with the upcoming hurricane season?
Okay, so in terms of where we stand right now for this winter, now keep in mind, this is a very weak La Nina, and it's going to be fleeting, but it will persist through the winter. It'll probably fizzle out this spring, so it's not going to be a long-lived La Nina.
Which is good for us for hurricane season, right?
It's good for us for hurricane season, yes. But as far as this winter goes, what La Ninas tend to do is create drier and warmer than normal conditions across the Gulf South, and obviously including Louisiana. Now, I mean, if you look back to December, we were absolutely warmer than normal. We were running about three degrees above normal, but we were wetter than normal. And keep in mind, the La Nina hadn't officially kicked in, and it's weak, so you don't get the signature isn't as predictable as you might expect. So far this January, as you well know, it's been pretty damn cold and miserable. And so this is not your typical La Nina conditions across this area. Like I said, the jet stream tends to get deflected northward, that tends to leave us, you know, with a lot of Gulf air coming up into Louisiana, but without the mechanisms to produce rainfall. So we tend to be drier and warmer through the winter in La Nina. And of course, in El Nino, it's the opposite. We tend to be cooler and wetter. So personally, I like the warmer and drier. I like La Nina winters, but I certainly don't like La Nina hurricane seasons because that tends to throw more storms at us.
Let's talk about the cold weather that's coming and what's happening with that and what does it portend for the rest of the winter, or does it portend anything?
Well, again, it's a weaker than normal La Nina. I mean, I would anticipate, you know, once we get out of this real cold air that's going to descend upon us over the next week, then when we add the numbers up at the end of the season, it's likely we'll be warmer than normal and we'll probably be drier than normal. But, you know, only time will tell. Because like I said, with a weak La Nina, it's really anybody's guess. But that's what I would expect to see for the rest of the season. But having said that, going into the rest of this week, we do have a little coastal system that's going to spin up. That's going to bring us some rain Friday and into Saturday. And then a cold front's going to sweep through Saturday night, and it's going to usher in some pretty chilly air. It'll start moving in on Sunday. You'll feel the difference. But by Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, we're going to have some pretty darn cold air descending upon South Louisiana. And expect a freeze, probably a light freeze. Some of the models actually have us getting down into the mid-20s, but I don't think many of the forecasters are really buying into that right now. But it's going to be damn cold, probably, you know, lows around 30, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, with high temperatures, low 40s. It's going to be pretty darn cold, so just brace yourself.
And to be clear, we morphed from climate into weather there, just for those following at home. Real quick, Barry, can you tell anything else about more polar weather coming, or is it just too early to predict any of that?
Yeah, it's too early. Obviously, we have some polar weather coming over the next week to 10 days, but after that, it's anybody's guess.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always. And I didn't want to draw that distinction between climate and weather because they are two different things. We're going to take a break. We come back, we'll talk to Jacques Thibodeau, Director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, about the governor's plan to open a transitional center for homeless people on France Road, I think it is. And we'll talk to Steve Geller, and after that, we'll talk to Leslie Harris, get her take on the homeless. Another chilly January day, January 14th, Tuesday. Highs today of only 55, and that's going to be late in the afternoon. Right now, it's 40, feels like 34. Somebody texted in, thanks for the Jimmy Buffett, but I'm still freezing. Nothing I can do about that. Colonel Jacques Thibodeau joins us now, Director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Morning, Colonel. How are you?
Good morning, sir. How's it going today?
It's cold is how it is, but I guess, you know, it's better than being 95, right? Or at least that's what I say today. Then when it's 95, I'll say, man, I sure wish it was cold, but that's human nature. Let's talk about the governor's plan and your plan, GOSEP's plan, to deal with the homeless in New Orleans in this center. Let's start from the get-go, Colonel, and talk about where the center is going to be and what it's going to look like.
Well, the center is on France Road, 5601 France Road, and what it is, it's designed as a transitional center that provides wraparound services for the homeless population. And that means medical, that means mental health counseling, that means free hot meals, that means shower facilities. That means a safe place for them to stay over the course of the time from now all the way through the Super Bowl and through Mardi Gras.
So what happens after Mardi Gras?
Well, the first thing that I'll tell you is that we're faced with an unprecedented situation here in Louisiana, and the first that we've had nationally since 9/11. We have not had a terrorist attack with two major Department of Homeland Security events in 65 days since 9/11. So what we are, this plan is initial plan to prepare for and respond to these two Department of Homeland Security Tier 1 events, which are the highest risk level events. And part of that element is the ingress and egress routes. We provide this transition center as a safe place for these homeless citizens to be. And we hope that it jumpstarts the conversation on providing them the opportunity for a better life and future through this initial plan in a broader strategy of attacking the homeless situation across the state.
Let's talk about the security aspect of this. Is it to protect the homeless, or is it to protect people that are not homeless and people that are here for the Super Bowl in Mardi Gras, so that security, law enforcement can distinguish who's who and that kind of thing. Colonel, take me through that if you would.
Okay, well, one of the biggest strategies that we have is to look at all the facility around the French Quarter and the events that are occurring and look at the ingress and egress routes. Mm-hmm. That is a primary state mission to secure by the Department of Transportation Development and the State Police. So as we look at those ingress and egress routes coming and to have the homeless population in some of these major routes of transportation, either under an overpass or near an ingress or egress, presents a safety issue for them and for individuals that are moving through that area. So that's what this transition center is designed to do. We don't leave anybody behind. We want to make sure that everyone is safe for these two events. And the homeless people will have a safe place to be for this event. And it's a voluntary aspect for them, and it gives them the opportunity to be in this transition center. But the ingress and egress location is restrictive, and we just will not allow people there because of the security needs.
Tell me about the facility itself. What is it? Is it a big, giant building? Is it something that's been converted? They got bunks in there? What's it going to look like?
Well, it's a warehouse building, and it's got the vendor that we're using, the contractors providing tents. So there, it will be a facility that has medical stations. They will have mental health counseling. They will have shower facilities. They will have feeding, and they will have a warm place to sleep over the next roughly 60 days.
And there will be segregated areas for men and women, obviously, and some kind of security there?
Yes, there is. It's a complete wraparound transition center that you would see. There are administrative personnel. There are security personnel. There are segregated areas, of course, and there are just basically complete wraparound services is the way we describe it.
When it comes to terms here, and I get some texts here from people saying warehousing the homeless, because you mentioned it was a warehouse building. But, I mean, one person's warehouse is another person's shelter, right? It all depends on what services are available for the homeless. And, Colonel, when I first heard about this, to me it seemed like a good idea on the surface. The only issue I would have is what happens after Mardi Gras. Thoughts on that?
Well, the first piece is everyone deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. And that's what this will do for this portion of the time. Now, it's our intention to ask for a Presidential Stafford Act declaration, which we have already done, to have the federal government defer and absorb the cost of this shelter. And of course, there's always a concern as to what happens after. What I will say is at least we're providing 65-70 days in the short term, and we just hope that it does spark a larger conversation about how we can address it as a parish and city and state and then as a nation.
I'm going to be honest here and just tell you my initial reaction to this was I thought it was a good idea because it takes the homeless people and it gives them a place to live. It provides them access to the things that they need. When it comes to tourist areas and other areas, it prevents any incursion on that, okay? And it seems to me like a really good idea. What pushback are you getting? Well, tell you what, Colonel, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, okay? Because I want to know what kind of pushback you're getting because it seemed like a good idea. And the other question I have is that when it comes to low-barrier shelters, I've heard a lot of negative stuff about low-barrier shelters, some positive where, like you're talking about, medical help and psychological help and everything else to get people back on their feet. And I know there is a thought out there that people want to be homeless. I don't think that's the case for the majority of people. I think a lot of them out there are working and homeless, and I know there are plans. We'll talk to Leslie Harris later about getting them into housing, but I think what you're doing here seemed like a good idea to me because you're not just dispersing people. They're still together. They're just together in a different and maybe safer location. You can address all of that when we come back. Talking to Colonel Jacques Thibodeau, Director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, GOSEP, about the new transitional shelter center that they're opening, shelter, whatever you want to call it, on France Road. 720 traffic now, WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Colonel Jacques Thibodeau, Director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, talking about the new transitional center for homeless people in the area that's going to open on France Road. So I mentioned a couple of things before the break, Colonel, about it seems as though a really good idea. What kind of pushback are you getting from people, if any?
Well, first off, I think your comments are spot on. I think you hit the center of what we're trying to get to here. And everybody's working towards the same goal. The first aspect of it is our thoughts and prayers go out to all the families that either had a family member that was killed or injured. And then we're all working towards a common goal of trying to get through the Super Bowl and through Carnival in a safe manner for the millions of people that will be in the great city of New Orleans. So I don't think there's a term of pushback. I think that what you have is you have a conversation about what is a short-term transitional center and sheltering versus a long-term strategy. And I think in the end, we all have the same goal to try to eradicate homelessness across the state and the nation.
There is a balance between the working poor and people that are homeless and working and trying to get to work. I know we're going to talk to Leslie Harris about that and the location on France Road. However, there also is a concern. Everything's a balance, right, Colonel, with the security portion of it, the tourism part of it. It gets down to if you're homeless and in a bad spot, how convenient should it be for you as it relates to the needs of everybody else? And that's kind of what you're trying to achieve here.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things from GOSEP's standpoint, our primary job is to bring agencies together for a common mission, whether it be at the local level, the parish level, or the state level. That's what our job is, and that's exactly what we're trying to achieve here, is to treat them with dignity and give them a safe place to be, to where they're not at risk, and they have the opportunity to have some of those wraparound services.
So we've heard about low barrier shelters and different types of barriers. Are there going to be any type of, I don't know, drug testing, any kind of no alcohol allowed when it comes to this facility?
Well, the first aspect of a shelter is it's got to be safe. Okay, it has to be safe. So the security measures that are there is designed for the safety of the people there. And it is a low barrier shelter, which means it's a voluntary shelter for the people to stay in and out of. They're not confined to that area, but while they're in that area, they're subject to the security requirements of being safe. There's no illegal drug uses. There's no crimes allowed that obviously we would state. But in this realm, it is a voluntary shelter.
When it comes to getting this thing up and running, what are the logistics of that? Is it up and running now? When do you start moving people, or has that happened already?
It is up and running. We've been in discussions about it prior to the situation with the terrorist attack. But the terrorist attack, when the governor declared the state of emergency, really ramped up GOSEP's action. So it is up and running. It will start tomorrow and will be open at 5 a.m. And we will begin to transition people into the transition center and provide them the safe location for roughly 65 days.
So will they be forced to go there? Will they be allowed to stay under the overpass? Somebody texted in if they want to. What's the situation there, Colonel?
No, the situation with that is an ingress and egress route that has been deemed an area that we must secure for this DHS event. So they will not be allowed to stay there, but they will be given options. They will be given options if they choose to have a bus ticket to go to a different climate or location, for example, that will be afforded to them. And then they will be given the opportunity to go to the transition center, or they will have to move from the location where they are. So there's multiple options there.
I want to drill down on that for 1 second. I might be 30 seconds late for news here. I'll warn them ahead of time. But when it comes to a bus ticket or train ticket, so if they say, you know what, I got family here or there, I want to go to Miami, I want to go to wherever, Houston, that'll be available to them? You'll give them a bus ticket or whatever?
Yes, that's part of the strategy. If they have a family member where they can get back on their feet, that's one of the things we definitely want to offer to them.
And real quick, before we let you go, again, I think this is a good idea because nothing's going to be perfect no matter what you do. My only concern is the longevity of this. And are you guys looking at maybe keeping this going after Mardi Gras, or does it depend on funding, Colonel? What's the long-range plan?
Well, right now it's just going through the process of getting through these two events. We're hoping that we get a Stafford Act declaration that allows the federal government to absorb the costs. But right now it's just through the end of Carnival.
If you do get the Stafford Act, would this be a semi-permanent thing or a long-range thing?
That's something that there will be discussions about between the president, whether it be President Biden or President Trump, and the governor himself.
Well, it's going to be Biden. It better hurry up. Just kidding, Colonel. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Colonel Jacques Thibodeau, Director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Steve Geller on the other side of the news. Then we'll talk to Leslie Harris, get her take on this. Minute late. Sorry, guys. Time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. How you doing, Steve?
Doing good, Tommy. Coming off that high of five straight days of playoff football between college and NFL, it was awesome.
Any surprises as far as you're concerned with the NFL playoffs?
To me, I guess it shouldn't be too surprised, but I did not see the Texans being able to overmatch the Chargers like that. I thought this would be the Chargers' year to at least go a little bit further in the postseason, but same old Chargers over there, new head coach, it didn't even matter.
Yeah, those four interceptions didn't help.
No, not at all.
Let's talk about the Saints and the Mickey Loomis press conference yesterday. Some of the things that got your attention.
With Mickey Loomis talking yesterday, you know he's not going to say too much to the media, but there were little nuggets out of that I thought were pretty surprised. Basically, no major overhaul he feels is needed for this franchise right now, despite, you know, finishing with just five wins this past season, mentioning the fact that Director of Pro Personnel, Michael Parenton, and also the VP and Assistant General Manager, Jeff Ireland, and with college personnel, their jobs are safe going forward. He has no intentions of replacing them. And Mickey kind of scoffed at the rumors of him being, you know, thinking about retirement, and said that's not the case. The only thing he's thinking of is getting back to winning football and getting the Saints organization back to the playoffs. But like I said, the big one for me was no changes with your talent evaluators. And I thought at least that was a position, considering the last few drafts we've had with this Saints club, that there could be a change coming there, whether with Parenton or Ireland. But Mickey definitely said that will not be the case, and both will be retaining their job going forward. No surprise that, you know, he's high on the team right now. Things, there's still a lot you can build on after this disappointing season, and really laid a lot of it onto the injuries, which you can't fault him there. I know it sounds like an excuse, but when you look at your quarterback, your running back, your top receiver, and, you know, offensive lineman, a lot more in the mix with that, but what we saw from this team in the first 2 weeks, sadly, was not the team we saw throughout the rest of the year. And that kind of became the big, I guess you would say, excuse for Mickey Loomis not making a sweeping amount of changes going forward. And also said that they won't block any assistant coaches from taking interviews with other teams. Everybody's got their job safe for now, but obviously that's something that could change dramatically too when this team does hire a new head coach and they want to bring in their staff, because Mickey Loomis said also that he would not block the head coach, whoever they do hire, from wanting to make changes for staff members that they wanted to bring in.
Look, age is just a number. I'm a firm believer in that, but I had no idea Mickey Loomis was 68 years old. I thought he was like 50-something.
Well, Mickey will love to hear you say that, that's for sure.
I had no idea, really, I didn't. But let me just say this, and I'm looking at a story here from somebody, I don't know where it's at online, but they use the word scapegoat when it comes to injuries. But I deliberately asked you about the playoffs coming into this, because I'm watching the playoffs and I'm thinking, okay, well, what if Saquon Barkley goes down? What if Jalen Hurts
right.
goes down? What if Jaden Daniels goes down? What if Lamar Jackson goes down? What if Derrick Henry goes down? Well, you're talking about a different team, right? And I don't like the word scapegoat. I think sometimes there are cause and effect. And I don't think you can talk about what an impact player Taysom Hill is, what an impact player Alvin Kamara is, the importance of continuity at offensive line. I don't think you can just write all that off and saying, well, injuries happen. I think you have to look at the depth and the severity of the injuries, how long they affected the team. And that's this doesn't change anything about the draft history or anything else. But I do think there is some cause and effect there that people might be in an emotional response overlooking here about the Saints being so hard hit with injuries. And I'll shut up after this and let you talk. You can't just throw that together in week 15 and hope it all gels.
No, you know, we talked about the injuries obviously all season long being an issue with this team, and it's not an excuse. It's definitely a reality with this club. Mickey Loomis did address it, saying, you know, it was more prevalent this season than in the past, and they have to look into things and things that the connection with the New Orleans Pelicans having similar injury issues is just a coincidence and, you know, nothing in the building. He kind of joked that, you know, David Griffin, their executive vice president for the Pelicans, even joked, maybe it's something in the water at the facility. And I've made that joke. I don't know.
I think it's what they're waxing the floors with. That's what I would look at.
But yeah, between the injuries of the Saints and Pelicans to key players, it's not just one or two either. It's hard not to put it on that, especially since we saw what this team was able to do the first 2 weeks. Sure, it was against the Panthers and the Dallas Cowboys, but they looked like a juggernaut. And then once Eric McCoy went down in that Philadelphia Eagles game, it seemed like everything else just kind of fell apart for the Saints.
All right, let me take a break. We'll talk head coaching when we come back. We're talking to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. Mickey Loomis at his press conference yesterday, 7:52, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. Mickey Loomis' press conference yesterday, did he tip his hand at all, or did you get any idea about who the new Saints coach might be, or what are you hearing?
Nothing definitely tipped from Mickey, basically going into that it's going to be a process. They want to talk to everybody that's on their list of candidates and promise to be very thorough about it, looking to, you know, restore greatness to the franchise, a new leader of men, basically, to, you know, carry forward with this franchise that has missed the playoffs the last 4 years. They've completed three interviews so far and have some more lined up towards the end of this week as teams get ready for the divisional round of the playoffs.
You know, I was talking to Cajun Cannon about the salary cap issues. He said that maybe a guy like John Gruden, he mentioned that name, would be more willing to take the job given the salary cap issues than would an Aaron Glenn, who is looking to make a name for himself as a head coach. And Mike Dettillier said that Aaron Glenn would probably like to take the opportunity. But then the name Mike McCarthy comes up, and I'm thinking, in terms of the salary cap, established coach, looking to get well after the tampering by Jerry Jones, this might be an ideal situation for Mike McCarthy. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think that McCarthy is a damn good candidate. A lot of folks poo-poo it because it's just of his, you know, affiliation with the Dallas Cowboys. Was there since 2020. Finished with a record of 49-35 as their head coach over 5 years. A winning percentage of .583. Had three playoff appearances. He's got the experience, won a Super Bowl in Green Bay. I don't hate the idea of bringing in Mike McCarthy for an interview at all with this team. We're going to see also Cliff Kingsbury, the Commanders offensive coordinator, Kellen Moore, the Eagles OC, and a name folks are familiar with here, Joe Brady, Bills offensive coordinator, still in the mix for the job as well. Those interviews will be coming towards the end of the week as all three of those teams get ready for the postseason.
10 seconds left. Is McCarthy scheduled for an interview or not?
No, nothing scheduled yet. It's just all in the rumor mill right now that they expect to get something set up with him soon.
I will quote Vic Scirro, believe no rumor till it comes from Steve Geller. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Have a good day. All right, Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We'll talk to Leslie Harris as we come back. New Orleans City Council member, get the other side, or at least her side, of this new homeless facility that they're building on France Road. A lot going on. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Another chilly day in the Crescent City right now. It's 42, feels like 35, going up to only 55. That's going to be at the end of the day, though. Chance for showers tomorrow, highs of 57, 58. Then by Friday, highs of 64, 69. Saturday looking really wet. But then the cold front comes through, 57 for a high Sunday, then 42 on Monday, and only into the 30s on Tuesday and Wednesday. Leslie Harris joins us now, New Orleans City Council member. Morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. I got to ask about the dogs. Are they behaving or not?
They are. They're chilly. They're not used to this cold.
Maybe that's an idea. Keep it 62 in the house and they'll stop eating everything. Let's talk about the and I was talking to Colonel Jacques Thibodeau with the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. It's not just all a GOSEP thing. They're using DCFS, LDH, LHA, LDVA, LDWF, LWC, and other relevant state agencies. But let's talk about the plan here, Leslie, because, you know, I don't, you know, I've had a lot of conversations about this. I think homeless people are a lot of times mischaracterized. I think there are a lot of working homeless that need to be taken care of. However, when I heard this plan, I thought, you know what, this might be a good idea, but maybe not just end it at Mardi Gras, maybe have this continue on. Give me your thoughts on the plan as it was presented and your concerns.
Well, the plan was not necessarily presented to me. I received a copy on yesterday, heard about it on Friday. So no official has sat down with me to actually talk about the plan. What I'm getting is from the press and the media, and again, a document that I received that talks about housing folks for 3 months at a cost of about $16 million, with no real plan to extend that after the 3 months and in an area that really lacks any access to transportation. So my concern, Tommy, as I've said in other outlets, is that people who work, and there are a lot of homeless people who work, are not going to be able to get to city center to their jobs. People who have appointments at hospitals in the CBD aren't going to be able to get to those appointments easily. And I did not see, and I'm wondering about plans for transportation and other means to get people bused from what is basically near the Yacht Yard back down to city center so they can work, get to appointments, and other things that they need to get to. So that's my biggest concern. And listen, if this works, I hope it works. We do have a low barrier shelter. I visited it yesterday. That's run by Odyssey House and run very well by Odyssey House. And there's room for expansion because it's in the VA. So I think there were other opportunities that we could have collectively explored to get more people housed. And I can tell you that after the first Taylor Swift sweep, we did sit down with people from the governor's office and say, here is a plan. This is how much it will cost, and this is how many people it will house. And that plan was not considered, I don't think, and certainly was not put into effect by the governor's office.
So what was that plan that you presented? Where would people be housed? At the low barrier shelter near Odyssey House or something different?
People would be housed. They would go direct from off the streets into housing, supportive permanent housing, which is something that is best practices, and that's what we've been doing. So the city has housed around 750 people since the beginning of last year. We know that there are about 1,500 street homeless, so we're at 53% of our goal, getting people housed directly from the street into permanent housing. And so we asked the state for an additional $8.1 million to get the majority of the remainder of those folks into housing. And again, that was right after the Taylor Swift concert, and we did not get a response from the state.
The first thing I thought of when I heard about this was you and dispersal of people and moving them all over the place when there were plans and people were on lists to get, I guess, permanent housing. How would you call it, Leslie? Transitional housing?
It's supportive permanent housing. So, yeah, when the first sweep happened, people were dispersed. People who had vouchers in hand and were ready to get housed were dispersed from the Calliope encampment and pushed down and pushed into neighborhoods. That's the other concern with this plan, Tommy, is that there are going to be some people who say, listen, I don't want to go clear out there. I don't want to go into congregate housing. And so what I'm going to do is instead pick up my tent and go into neighborhoods. And that's what we saw happen after the first sweep.
We'll take a break. You're a brilliant woman. Nothing's perfect. I realize that. I do have a question about the $16 million and where do you get a breakdown of that, or will you get a breakdown of that? We can talk about it when we come back. And the other question I think that is a very valid concern is transportation. And you would think with $16 million or whatever money is available that somehow it can't be that expensive to get a bus to take people to work or to get them to their medical appointments. We'll talk more when we come back with Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council member. Again, nothing's perfect. This seemed like at least a step in the right direction. 821 traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL 826, talking to council member Leslie Harris about GOCEP's plan, the governor's plan to open a temporary shelter that can accommodate 200 people, 5601 France Road. The proposal is from Workforce Group, the company that Governor Landry's administration has chosen to operate the facility. The building's owned by the Port of New Orleans, sits along the Industrial Canal across from Pontchartrain Park. Cost of $11.4 million for 2 months, with a possible one-month extension, increasing it to $16.2 million. Some things that have gotten attention, Leslie Harris, state will pay $117 per hour for armed security guards, the most of any personnel. I don't know if that's because of the number of personnel, et cetera. Medical services coordinator, safety officer, ship supervisor, each costs $115 per hour. You got to have a secure facility. The devil is in the details. Are you comfortable with the details that you've seen? Are they available to you? Or tell me through about all that.
Again, Tommy, what I have is the proposal I think that everybody has, which is from Workforce, which has a line-by-line number of various things and items that is planning to be put into this warehouse. My intel is that this is all going to be stood up by the 15th, which is tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I know that my chief of staff took a drive out there on Sunday, and there were some machines out there. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to get this all stood up. But again, if it works, it works. My concern, as I said, is transportation. The nearest bus stop is about a mile away.
And let me get back to that. Is there anything in the proposal that mentions anything about transportation that you found?
Not that I see. There's no sort of vehicle purchase or bus purchase in here. I know there were some talks about joining with RTA. RTA itself is stretched thin, as we all know, and is not necessarily the most reliable. So if you have a shift worker who has to get on a job at 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't know that they can rely on bus service or RTA service to get down to the quarter to wash dishes.
It would seem, though, Leslie, if I might jump in for a second, that if this situation, if this homeless thing is going to be addressed, it's got to be addressed from a lot of different angles with a lot of different players. And it would seem as though arranging transportation, you know, not like a Uber or anything, but just some kind of mass transportation, be it a twice daily bus or three times, whatever it is, either to get people to medical appointments or to downtown, that wouldn't be that big of a thing to put together, would it?
I don't know. I really honestly, Tommy, I just don't know. And that's part of the concern, is that we are not wrapped into these conversations. This could be the best thing since sliced bread. But again, we do have a low barrier shelter that is run by Odyssey House that houses about 300 people. There's room for expansion going up at the VA, which is in City Center. If we wanted, if we had sat down with the governor and talked about this proposal, we could have easily expanded the low barrier shelter, again, run by Odyssey House, with addiction services, with counseling services, with food service, and put this in the low barrier shelter. It may be a good idea. I'm in a wait and see sort of mode, but I also know that we ask for about half this money to house people, and we're not provided that money. So I just don't know if this is throwing away good money after bad.
Let me just tell you where I am as a citizen and not as a brilliant attorney as you are, okay? Just as a citizen, a common sense, a dumb guy from the West Bank, it seems like the beginning of a good idea that has to have some more details worked out, and it seems like you and Jacques Thibodeau and some other people have to get together in the same room with some other partners and hammer this out, because it seems like it could work and not shut it down after Mardi Gras. Thoughts?
I'm happy to do so. I've been in rooms with other people who are representatives of the governor. I'm always open to conversation and collaboration. That's what I do, and I pride myself on that. I'm not setting this down as a bad idea. I just don't know enough about it.
That's why everybody needs to get together and finally solve a problem. Because, Leslie, that's what I'm all about, just like your dogs with the pillows when I said turn the AC down to 62. Thank you.
I'll try it, Tommy.
Pleasure
Thank
as always, you,
you
bet. 8:30, when we come back, we're going to talk about terrorism, and ICE has been encouraging attacks like the New Year's Day one for years. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Joshua Fisher Birch joins us now, a researcher at the Counter Extremism Project. Good morning, Joshua. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How about yourself?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time. I find it interesting, looking at this story at NOLA.com from our friend Sam Carlin that you're quoted in. When you heard about the Bourbon Street attack, it didn't seem strange or odd to you at all, did it?
No, unfortunately. I mean, this really fits the profile of a large quantity of ISIS propaganda that the group and the group's online supporters have been putting out for years in terms of suggestions for the types of attacks to commit, as well as encouraging people to commit those attacks.
And in reading this article and in our conversation this morning, one thing I wanted to bring up is that, you know, I see the video of the Bourbon Street attacker riding his bicycle on Halloween that was captured on video. And you just, I guess, have to wonder, not to be paranoid or anything, Joshua, but who might be riding their bicycles around today or driving around or looking for weaknesses, not just here, but all over the country. Am I being paranoid when I say that or just realistic?
Well, I mean, this is the problem of lone actor terrorism, and this is the idea of individuals who become radicalized and inspired to commit acts of violence and do this outside of networks where they're not communicating with others and where this is not being planned. So certainly on one hand, you know, the threat of lone actor terrorism exists. On the other hand, you know, this type of paranoia of suspecting one another, of, you know, these divisions in society is also one of the goals of the groups behind these types of attacks and behind groups that inspire these types of attacks. You know, they thrive on division.
Let's talk about communications and networks and online magazines and so forth. What is, when did ISIS begin to do this, or has it always been in their playbook? Tell me about all of it, if you would, Joshua, please.
Sure. So, I mean, this online component of ISIS propaganda has been incredibly important, you know, since the group's founding. This is one of the ways that they were able to get foreign fighters to come and join them fighting in Syria and Iraq, you know, and this, you know, this continues to this day, you know, even though this is now over a decade later, a lot of this type of propaganda, you know, these magazines, these videos, these guides that the group and similar groups have put out, it remains online. And in the case of ISIS, there are pro-ISIS online supporters who continue to produce this content, to translate it, and who really spread this. And, you know, this was something that actually ISIS pointed out in their recent online newsletter where, you know, where they acknowledged the New Orleans attack. And they said, you know, this was done by someone inspired by ISIS propaganda, and it's incredibly important that people continue to share and translate it.
So let's talk about this whole ISIS playbook and the ISIS magazine, and do I go looking for it? Does it come looking for me? Take me through all of that, if you would, Joshua.
Sure. So, you know, this type of ISIS propaganda exists on very specific parts of the internet. You know, so there are platforms like Telegram. There are other types of communications platforms they use. In some cases, it's shared on social media, and it's really one of the goals of ISIS online supporters is to maintain their online presence, maintain that community. But also, it at certain points, and especially like right now, part of this is also about sharing that propaganda to a larger audience so that they can reach a larger group of people. However, when they do that, they also risk further takedowns from social media companies. They risk, you know, law enforcement partnering with communications companies to remove these online communities.
So I'm looking at this online magazine affiliated with ISIS, Rumiya, however you say it. Could I access that if I looked that up or not? I don't want to, but I'm just saying, could I?
Yeah, if you looked hard enough, you would be able to find that. And, you know, it's there are definitely parts of the internet that don't require a great deal of skill, you know, where you can find older content like Rumiya. You know, that I think the issue you're referring to came out in 2016. But then more recent content, such as ISIS's weekly Al-Naba newsletter, you know, continues to be available on a wide variety of sites.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about the Bourbon Street terror attack right out of the ISIS playbook. Our guest is Joshua Fisher Birch, research at the Counter Extremism Project. And I know Christopher Wray said that lone wolf terrorist attacks, that's the biggest threat that the country's facing. The FBI director, associate director, I guess, Christopher Wray, saying that vehicle ramming's been used by extremists for years. And how do you go about identifying this or preventing it? Or is this the new normal? 851, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 856, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Joshua Fisher Birch, researcher at the Counter Extremism Project, talking about the Bourbon Street attack and ISIS. So, Muslims are not all bad people. Violent extremists are. I'm looking, Joshua, at the Carnegie Endowment website here about ISIS. The Islamic State presents itself as the representative of authentic Islam as practiced by the early generations of Muslims, Salafism, and it draws on an especially strict brand of Salafism, in particular, Wahhabism. So to lump all of this together with Muslims is wrong, A, and B, it's not accurate. So what exactly does ISIS believe, and how do they get a guy like the Bourbon Street attacker to buy into what they profess and then manifest his beefs by driving a truck through a group of people?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, it's important to recognize that about 99.9% of the victims of ISIS have been other Muslims. This is a violent extremist group, you know, that promotes a very specific ideology. They view all of their enemies as being united against them. And, you know, this is a very, very small percentage of, you know, of extremists. It's and it's incredibly important in the aftermath of an event like this, you know, that to not allow violent extremists to sow division. You know, whether you're talking about ISIS or you're talking about white supremacist groups, these groups, you know, they need hatred in order to recruit. And it's important that people can, you know, stand together against division and further hatred. But to answer your question about, you know, ISIS propaganda, you know, this is important to remember that this is the early part of the investigation, that this is something that will be ongoing. And so regarding this specific individual's radicalization, you know, it's going to take research, it's going to take investigations, and, you know, law enforcement is going to have to, you know, let people know, you know, the results of these investigations. But, you know, but part of this is that these types of groups prey on people, you know, who are socially isolated, who have a lack of community, you know, who have psychological factors, financial problems, family problems. And, you know, and then this is combined with, in some cases, online radicalization and then the desire to do harm to others. And I think it's important to note here also that the attacker spoke in a video posted to social media about, at first, he was thinking of, you know, of harming his family. Mm-hmm. He considered his family his first target before reassessing. So, you know, this type of propaganda, and then the people who create this type of propaganda, these, you know, ISIS online communities, they are looking for individuals who they can convince to commit attacks.
Joshua,
and, you know, this is
Never enough time. I hope you come back when we have more time, because this is important stuff. All right, into the 9 o'clock hour we go. A text pops up from 7449 saying Tommy just drove by an accident in New Orleans East, so they got the eastbound I-10 closed. A car flipped lane in the middle of the interstate between the east and the twin span. We'll look into it and keep you posted on that. January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and Saturday was National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. We were supposed to have Scott Vaughn on Friday to talk about that and about what he does with Unbranded, but the Archer Barrier thing happened and the CEO was in town, so we had to bump him. But we wanted to have him on today to talk about Unbranded and human trafficking in general. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Scott's his dad is a former NFL official. He's a former SEC official. Do you remember on a lighter note before we get started here, the most heated argument you ever got into on a football field with a coach?
you know, my position was out on the middle of the field, so I tried to stay out there and avoid the sidelines as much as I could. So I didn't
You just noticed them nodding, and I just, if they're saying, yeah, okay, sure, fine, whatever, is that pretty much it?
Well, you know, the big thing is if the coaches knew the rules, we wouldn't have so many arguments with them.
There you go.
Unfortunately.
There you go.
Unfortunately,
right.
You know, they get paid millions of dollars to coach these college football teams, and they don't know the rules.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Unbranded, Scott. First of all, before we get to Unbranded, about human trafficking and how big of a problem it is, because this just floors me when there can be slavery existing under our very noses.
Yeah, you know, that's true. It seems like slavery is more prominent today than it was over 200 years ago, but it's just not talked about that much.
Wow. Tell me how bad the problem is.
Well, I tell you, you know, currently hundreds of thousands of boys and girls throughout the United States are being sex trafficked, and hundreds of thousands of more are at risk every day of being sex trafficked. So, you know, we're trying to help with the prevention part of that on the front end, but we're also involved on the treatment aspect of it by removing the tattoos that are placed on these boys and girls by a sex trafficker that claims ownership of a human being.
Tell me about that for people that don't know. You deal with this every day, Scott, but people listening, this might be the first time they heard about it. You're talking about almost like sometimes a barcode or just a mark where it's like they would do with branding a piece of cattle or a cow or something like that, right?
It really is no different than a rancher would brand his livestock to claim ownership. So what a sex trafficker does is he puts his brand on a boy or a girl so that other sex traffickers know who that boy or girl belongs to. And it could be the trafficker's name. It could be a symbol. It could be a bed of roses. It could be a barcode. It could, you know, I've seen crowns, the cash emblem. Also, I've seen lots and lots of different varieties. But, you know, and then when a sex trafficker will sell a boy or a girl to another sex trafficker, then that sex trafficker puts their brand on that boy or girl. So they end up with multiple tattoos on different areas of their body. And then we come in and we remove those with state-of-the-art laser technology that I have in my clinic in Metairie. And it just is very crucial and critical to the healing process for these boys and girls.
Well, and just as people get a tattoo to remember something that they want to remember fondly, right? The opposite is true when it comes to what your organization does in removing these tattoos, because I would think it's hard to move on when you're looking at this and you have a constant reminder of it.
It is. You know, as I always say, these boys and girls can go to a psychiatrist every day and feel like they've made some progress, make, you know, 3 or 4 steps forward. But then when they get home in the evening or afternoon and they look in the mirror and they have that constant reminder slapping them in the face of the physical, mental, and sexual abuse that they endured for however many years they did it, then they take those 3 or 4 steps back. So it really is crucial in the healing process for these boys and girls.
And it's not a pleasant thing to talk about, but I do like to have you on occasionally to, because so many different things have different facets and different sides to it and different, you know, layers. And when it comes to sex trafficking, the healing portion of it is important. And part of that healing is getting rid of the tattoos. And that's what Unbranded is all about. You guys also have a raffle going on with Super Bowl tickets that it has the blessing of the NFL officials, correct? Tell me all about that.
Yeah, you know, that's correct. Back in May of 2024, I reached out to the National Football League Referee Association because of my affiliation and contacts with them over the years. And I told them about the nonprofit that we started and what we did. And when they looked into it and vetted us, they voted unanimously to support us. And the way they did that, because Super Bowl 59 is being played in New Orleans this year, they've donated 10 Super Bowl tickets to our nonprofit organization. So what they wanted us to do is get donations for the raffle tickets. So anyone that donates $200 will receive a raffle ticket to win 2 Super Bowl tickets, 2 Super Bowl game tickets to this upcoming Super Bowl 59 that's going to be played right here in New Orleans. And since we have 10 tickets, there's going to be 5 winners. So there'll be 5 winners drawn, and each winner will receive a pair of Super Bowl 59 game tickets that's going to be played February 9th. This year right here in New Orleans, so just next month.
How do people go about getting a ticket, Scott?
they can go to unbranded.org, and right on the homepage, it gives you all the information. And right by the image of the Super Bowl raffle tickets, there's a donate now button, and they can choose how many donations they want to make. And right now we're doing a special to where if you donate $1,000, so $200 donations, you'll get an extra raffle ticket. So you won't get five raffle tickets, you'll get six.
I know.
And this is completely, you know, tax deductible. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so it's totally tax deductible.
And I just want to get to the legitimacy of your organization, because so many times people are jaded and they doubt this, they doubt that. For the NFL officials to get involved here, that is like the ultimate vetting that you could have, especially when it comes to Super Bowl tickets. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very pleased that they got involved and they see the importance of it. You know, just here in Louisiana between 2023 and 2024, we had a 74% increase in sex trafficking cases confirmed. And it's hard to put into words the boys and girls that I deal with and the stories that I hear while I'm doing the treatments on them. And it's just very disturbing and downright sickening that goes on here in our country.
I would guess, and the name of the organization is spot on accurate with Unbranded. I would think just as people share their stories when they're getting a tattoo, I guess sometimes you hear the negative stories when you're removing them, huh?
Correct. We do. You know, I hear the negative stories when I have a survivor or two or three together that are coming in to get the treatment. And as a provider, you know, they start to get more comfortable with me the more they see me, and they open up and they start to tell their story. And it's just very, very disturbing. It just, I'm speechless every time they start telling their story.
I know you and I appreciate the work you do, but I just wanted to get this out there because I don't think anything can be more vetted than the NFL and the Super Bowl, because they are very, very protective of the shield and the brand and everything else. So the name of the organization is Unbranded. He's got some Super Bowl tickets or Unbranded. The NFL officials gave them some Super Bowl tickets that they're raffling off, and it all goes to benefit Unbranded. Tell me again, Scott, how people get tickets.
They can go to unbranded.org, and right on the homepage, there's an image of the Super Bowl raffle tickets and a donate now button. And I want to let everybody know, too, the money that's raised for this, we're going to be able to purchase a portable laser, because weekly I have different organizations around the state of Louisiana that are reaching out to me and trying to figure out how they can get the boys or girls that are being taken care of in their organization, how can they get them down to Metairie? And it's just for transportation reasons, it's kind of a logistical nightmare to be able to do that. So we'll be able to purchase a portable laser. We'll be able to buy the vehicle to transport the laser in, and we'll be able to travel around the state of Louisiana and go to the organizations where these boys and girls are being taken care of and treat them on their location, you know, in their facility. So that's just really going to be a game changer.
It's not pleasant to talk about. It's an ugly part of the healing process, of an ugly thing that's going on in society underneath our very noses. Scott Vaughn, thank you so much. Go to unbranded.org, was it?
Yes, that's correct. Unbranded.org.
And just generally speaking, for people, to be on the lookout for people that are being trafficked, what are some of the signs?
Well, you know, I tell in the speeches that I give that the days of the white van circling the mall parking lot or the school parking lot are pretty much over. I tell parents all the time, pay attention to what your kids are doing on social media, because that's what sex traffickers use today. They use Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, any of those gaming platforms that kids get on, because kids don't really know who they're communicating with. You know, they may think they're communicating with another 14 or 15-year-old boy or girl when they're really communicating with a 30 or 40 year old man or woman that's, you know, trying to traffic them and, you know, gain their trust so they can traffic them.
And once they're gone, they're gone.
That's it. That's correct.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your time and your work. God
Thank
bless
you
all. Scott Vaughn, founder of Unbranded. You go to unbranded.org, find out more about it. January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and it is astounding how that can go on underneath our very noses in this country with so many young boys and girls, and it happens, and Scott sees the victims of them. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Dr. Judy Ho about keeping New Year's resolutions. Also, about the aftermath of Bourbon Street attack and dealing with collective grief, PTSD, and more. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. 9:27, we like to talk about mental health every other Tuesday here because we know it's very important. And we're joined now by Dr. Judy Ho, PhD, ABPP, ABPDN. Well, we're all grown-ups. We don't have to spell it. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
Hi, Tommy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books, Stop Self-Sabotage, The New Rules of Attachment. You can get those at the usual outlets. Dr. Judy, we were going to talk about New Year's resolutions, and we will, but I don't think we've spoken to you since the New Year started. And, of course, you know what happened on Bourbon Street. You lived here for a while. You're familiar with the area. What would you advise, or how would you advise people to deal with this? Maybe they weren't directly affected, but what can the area expect, I guess, maybe would be a better way to put it?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's obviously really difficult because essentially the whole community has been through a community-wide trauma. Everyone's response to it is going to be different, but, you know, one thing that, you know, part of the reason why I was in your neighborhood for a couple of years while I was a postdoc was that we were working with the Hurricane Katrina aftermath. And I remember working with the local mental health providers, and they themselves were having PTSD symptoms while they were trying to help their clients who had similar responses. And so it can be challenging because you're leaning on people in your community, which is what we all should do, but everybody's been through that trauma as well. And so I think that it's a tough part of it, but it's also what can be comforting because you know the person that you're talking to really knows what you're talking about, and they're empathizing from a shared experience standpoint as well, you know, as opposed to just saying, well, yeah, I think I might understand what that's like, but they don't really know, you know. So some pros and some cons with that, but I think overall, we have to just lean in with the people that we trust most and have the conversations to try to process through it at the pace that you're most comfortable with.
What are some of the things that collectively, maybe as the community, we might be feeling individually, but as it relates to something like this, that we're likely to feel?
I think that, you know, there's a couple of the things that are the most common is many of the stages of grief. And so, again, people go through those stages in different ways. I don't think it's linear, but there are people who are going to be very angry. They're looking for who to blame and who to try to, you know, prosecute because of what happened. And then there are people who are going to be sinking into an existential crisis of sorts and become really depressed. There are people who are going to be bargaining, especially if they've lost somebody. It's like they're in disbelief, and it's like they're still trying to get that person back, even though they're not here anymore. Or maybe that person is a healthy person back if they've been one of the injured people. And then even just, you know, this feeling of denial, just complete denial that anything has happened. And there are some people who respond in that way because it's protective. Like, well, nothing's happened. I don't have to take any more precautions. I don't have to think about this neighborhood in any different ways. I'm just going to keep living my life. And of course, some of that is adaptive, but to a degree, it may not be, especially if you're putting yourself in harm's way.
Dr. Judy, I got to apologize to you because I got a lot of things zooming across the desk throughout the 4 hours and a couple of texts pop up. Is Dr. Judy safe in California? Give Dr. Judy my love. I didn't even ask about you and the fires in California, and I am so sorry about that. How are you? And I was focused on Bourbon Street and everything I'm doing here this morning. I didn't even think about asking you about that. How are you and your family and the area dealing with the fires?
Well, thank you so much for asking. We are fine in terms of where I live, but I have many friends and colleagues who've had to evacuate, and actually some who have completely lost their homes. So definitely very heavy feeling in our community right now. And similar to what I was mentioning to you, we have a mixture of responses as well to this tragedy. And there are people who are looking for someone to blame and to point the finger at, and that's making them feel productive. Other people who are still in denial about losing their homes. There are people who are really just, you know, still bargaining, like, well, maybe we haven't lost everything. Actually, one of my neighbors who just moved in across the street, you know, they just rented the place across the street. They said that their house in the Palisades completely burned down. And then her husband has been just kind of going by their place, like driving by the last couple of days, like just seeing if there's anything to salvage. I mean, so it's just, it's very sad, but it's also a completely understandable reaction that he's like, well, maybe there's something that hasn't burnt up and I can still recover it.
Can you, Dr. Judy, where you live, are you smelling this? Are you seeing this smoke all the time? Is that, I'm just trying to get a feel.
Yes. Yeah, we have a lot of ash. I mean, this is, it sounds ridiculous to even say that that's a problem, but yes, we have a lot of ash all over our yard and at our front door. We just kind of sweep it every couple of days. I mean, it's insane only because the nearest fire is about maybe 10 miles away from us. Mm-hmm. And we're still getting the ash blown. The, you know, air quality is impacted. So we've not been going outside on most days and staying inside and turning off all of our HVACs and things like that. But, you know, one of the worst fires, I think, is about 15% contained right now, but it's been over a week. So the progress is very slow.
So I don't know that much, and I apologize about California, other than having been there a couple of times. Is this something that's in the back of your mind? Is it something that could threaten your home or not?
We're not in a high fire risk area because we don't have a ton of vegetation around us. But I used to live very close to actually the, I just moved actually a few years ago away from essentially the epicenter of the fire. I probably would be in the next zone to be evacuated right now. So I was living in West Los Angeles. And so essentially Santa Monica and West Los Angeles, parts of it have been affected, but it's more the northern parts. I was living in the more southern part. So I would be maybe like a mile and a half away from what where things are going on right now if I hadn't moved.
How important is it when you go through anything to talk to somebody about it? Because I think sometimes, I don't know if it's men more than women, you know, we want to be the and I'm dating myself here with the Gary Cooper, the strong, and I like old movies, the strong, silent type. Don't talk about anything. Uh-huh. Just stuff it way down there and just deal with it. And you say to yourself, nobody cares. Everybody's got problems. But how important is it from your own mental health standpoint? I'm talking about the generic you here, that people talk to others about their issues.
I think it is important. And as you mentioned, there are certain, maybe like the gender cultural norm, as well as certain other cultural norms, like in Asian culture, that's kind of how you're taught to deal with it too. For the most part, at least in mainstream Asian culture, it's like, just stuff it in and don't say anything. But I do think that there's value in processing it with a few people or even just one person, and everybody's pace of that processing is different, right? So there are people who want to talk about it for 30 minutes, an hour, and then there are some other people who maybe they just need to acknowledge that it's happening, you know, get some validation that they're not alone in how they're feeling, and then they can move on. But I think that it's very important that you express it in some way, even if it's a brief way to somebody, because when you try to ignore it, when you try to stuff it down, it's going to come out in other ways. And what I've seen most commonly is that it comes out in a physical way. People all of a sudden are saying they're having headaches, they get shingles, you know, they have GI problems, because your mind and your body are connected. And when you stuff something down and don't acknowledge it, your body essentially puts itself in a state of fight or flight, because it's like, well, something's going on, it's not being acknowledged, but I need to have my antenna up. And so it's actually really unhealthy for you, both from a physical and psychological standpoint, to not process it at all.
When it comes to the post-traumatic stress part of it, the delay, I guess, and I guess it goes to stages of grief, because I was thinking about that. Is it related to the denial and anger, acceptance, and everything else? That can apply to any type of loss, right? Because we associate maybe sometimes grief with the loss of a loved one or death, but all of those stages, first of all, have those been proven to be clinically accurate? And secondly, can that apply to any type of loss, whether it's a pet, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a job or anything along those lines, or maybe a bad health diagnosis?
Definitely, yeah. So I would say that with more research into the Kubler-Ross model, people have found that it's not necessarily linear, but that these stages are universal in that most people experience at least a portion of them at varying times when they experience grief and loss. So you may not do it in that order that she first proposed, but that these are the common and most universal responses to any kind of grief and loss. And yes, it doesn't have to be the loss of a person. It could be the loss of your identity, the loss of a community, the loss of a stage in life, like when you were working and now you're retired, the loss of a type of relationship, like you had a certain relationship with your child and now it's a different kind of relationship. And grief and loss, and I know we've talked about this before, Tommy, but just any form of grief and loss is universal also to the human experience, right? Not every human experiences every single event or situation, but grief and loss is like something that every single human being will experience if you lived long enough and multiple times in most cases.
Interesting point about the difference in the nature of a relationship between a parent and a child as they go through life stages, getting married, et cetera. We'll pick it up. We come back with Dr. Judy O, our good friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll talk about keeping New Year's resolutions. We've passed quit day, I think it is, when most people give up their New Year's resolutions, but it's not all or nothing at all. There are stages of this. We'll talk about it when we come back, 938, 22 till 10. Any questions, comments, Oakland Jeweler Talk and text lines open at 504-260-1870. Traffic now on WWL. 943, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Tuesday morning, we like to talk about mental health occasionally every other week. And we do that with Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, let's talk about New Year's resolutions and making changes to your life, hopefully for the better. I know dry January is something that's going around. I'd not heard about this, but apparently people quit drinking for a month. You know about this?
Oh, yeah. I've had some friends do that. And I think it makes them feel really accomplished. Like, hey, I can do this. And it makes me feel healthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody sets different kinds of New Year resolutions. I have not heard that there was an official quit day. What day is that?
Crucial Quit Resolution Day happened last week. I forgot exactly what day it was, but it was a day where most people give up, at least not, I don't think it was something that you celebrate as much, and maybe I phrased that poorly, as much as just the day that, second Friday of January, January when, Tim? January 10th, when most people give up on their New Year's resolutions.
How interesting.
How do you...
Yeah, it makes sense.
Well, tell me why it makes sense.
Well, because people are so full of energy the first day of the year, like, oh my gosh, everything's going to change. And what happens is, of course, probably 10 days in, they've had, you know, one little setback, as everybody does. And then, like you were saying right before the break, people treat it as an all or none. They're like, well, forget it. If I couldn't do it on New Year's Day and I've already, you know, made a mistake so early, I should just give up. And a lot of people do give up by mid-January. But I think it's important to, one, not put so much pressure on yourself, and also, two, set your expectations that you're going to have setbacks. Like, if you go into this thinking you're going to have setbacks on your way to reaching your goal, then you're not going to be so surprised or upset with yourself or sort of be so black and white about it when an inevitable setback occurs, because it does for everyone. And also, one thing that I try to remind people of is that it takes about 4 to 6 weeks to make a new habit feel like the norm. So in the beginning, for the first month to month and a half, it's going to feel a bit treacherous. It's going to feel hard. And that is also normal. So I think sometimes people give up because they're like, well, I've been trying to do this for a couple weeks and it still feels like it's really hard. And that is completely normal from a brain science standpoint. Like, it just takes time for your brain to establish a new habit, and you have to give it a little bit of patience before you completely throw in the towel. Also, I think it's important to revise your goal. Like, if something isn't working for you, don't throw out the entire theme, but maybe think about, well, maybe I just aimed a little too high too quickly. So what is like a medium level goal that I can just focus on for the next couple of months? And then we can kind of reassess and see if I want to put the original goal back on the table after that.
And we set an artificial deadline. Like, you know, I can remember having gone through this as a younger person where it's like, well, that's it. Well, it's only January 10th. You still got a lot of time. You don't have to wait until next New Year's to try to do something different. Is it better from a behavioral standpoint? Somebody was talking, when was it? The other day about running a marathon. 2 weeks ago, I had a conversation with somebody. And they weren't a runner. And I said, well, I'll tell you, and I've never run a marathon, but what helped me get up to like 10 miles was, first of all, I've got replacement knees, so I would suggest you don't do that. I would suggest you go with the elliptical machine. But not to digress, but I started by running one house, and then the next day two houses, and then three houses and four houses. And it was amazing how quickly you could build up distance. Is it the same when it comes to modifying your behavior? Do you start with one day and then try to go to 2 days?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's a great example of how modifying your behaviors can really lead to success, as well as feelings of accomplishment along the way. Doesn't mean that you don't have your big goal that you visualize, like, okay, well, here's what I would like to do maybe in a few months or a year from now. But on a day-to-day basis, or on a week-to-week basis, it should be essentially steps on a ladder, right? To get to the top of the ladder, you have to have those smaller steps in between planned out. And also celebrate each step of that ladder. You know, sometimes people will say, well, I'll celebrate when I get to the top. But, you know, we as human beings were built to respond to more frequent positive reinforcement, not like waiting a whole year to get reinforcement. So reward yourself along the way. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could just be an acknowledgement of, hey, I did this. You know, one person that you trust, you know, sharing your progress along the way with them and having them celebrate you, you know, or just giving yourself a little treat here and there, like, okay, well, you know, I've done this for a month. I've stuck to these small goals along the way. Like, I'm going to treat myself to, you know, something. I'm going to buy myself something. Something small. It doesn't have to be expensive, but, you know, just to commemorate this. It is important that you earmark your achievements along the way. Otherwise, you do lose steam. You do lose motivation. And you also lose sense of exactly where you are. It's like, if you're not celebrating it, then you're also not reassessing and thinking about, well, what's working and what isn't. And assessing along the way and making improvements and adjustments is a huge part of that success.
Somebody texted in, and this is a kind of serious text about trying to quit drinking and having a hard time doing it. And how do you know when you have a drinking problem?
Yeah, good question. I think that when you know you have a problem, I think it's a couple of things. You know, some signs to watch out for is you can't stop thinking about drinking, and you try to cut down, but you're unsuccessful, and it's affecting major areas of your life, like how you function on a day-to-day basis, your emotional health, your physical health, or your relationships. If one or more of those things are happening, then I think it is time to think about cutting down on drinking, if not just stopping completely for a little while. And I think it's important to, well, first of all, if it feels really hard, consult a professional. But if you want to try it on your own, it's important to really remember why you're doing this. You know, what's the value of reducing or quitting drinking? And it's important to assess that, because otherwise the goal is going to feel empty. And then when things get hard, you'll just go right back to the drinking. For most people, drinking becomes just a habit. Like, it's just something that they start doing. But for other people, it's because it's a coping strategy. It's like a way that they escape something that they need to deal with. And so if that's the case, you need to learn other coping strategies to help you to deal with emotional stress, physical stress, anything that's going on in your life. Don't rely on alcohol, because, of course, the next day the problems are there, plus the problems that were caused by you drinking too much alcohol. So a big step is really just assessing why you're doing this and why it's important. And then I think from there, it's just about substituting in something else that might be healthier.
Let me wrap it up with this. Somebody wants to go back to post-traumatic stress syndrome, because we addressed it earlier, but they said they're watching the fires in L.A. here in New Orleans, and it's giving them some Katrina PTSD, because it's a joyous place that's kind of turning into hell. And you have kind of experience with both, right, Dr. Judy?
Yeah. So it can be really tough. I think that natural disasters, I mean, they definitely can trigger, even if it's a different kind of natural disaster, right? Just like kind of the wake of it and how apocalyptic everything looks. I would say to this listener that it might be helpful to step away from the news a bit. I mean, it's like, it almost feels like a train wreck you can't turn away from. But I think it is important in terms of protecting your mental health to step away from the news or just only, you know, set a timer, essentially, like, okay, 30 minutes of news and I got to turn it off and do something else, because otherwise it really does color your thoughts and how you feel. And I know that from experience, from both this natural disaster as well as, you know, as you mentioned, being a peripheral experience of Katrina.
Dr. Judy, thank you as always. We appreciate your insight and your advice, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay? Tell Luca hi for us.
We will. Thanks so much.
You
take
bet.
Good care, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye.
Stay safe. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.